Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia to deliver the 2025 Bradford Oration. And following her address, she'll be joined by the Daily Telegraph's John Rolfe for a Q&A. Please welcome to the stage Michelle Bullock.
Well, good morning. I have to say the Premier's a very hard act to follow, and some of the things he was talking about probably a little more engaging on what I'm going to speak on. But anyway, we'll see how we go. I'd first of all like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, and I'd like to pay my respects to Elders past and present. And I have to say it's a real honour to be here to deliver this Bradford Oration today. I'm very delighted that the Daily Telegraph asked me to do it. Dr. John Bradfield's name is etched into Australia's history as a visionary of transformative infrastructure, as we've heard. As the chief engineer behind the Sydney Harbour Bridge, Bradfield didn't merely build a crossing, he built a connection, one that shaped how Sydney functioned, moved and grew. His legacy reminds us that infrastructure doesn't just support a nation, it expands its possibilities. While physical infrastructure such as transport networks continue to shape our cities and economy today, it's increasingly digital infrastructure and growth in the digital economy that underpins how people live, work and transact. Innovations such as mobile phone apps and cloud software are now woven into the fabric of everyday life for most Australians. Among the most frequently and widely used pieces of digital infrastructure in the country is our payment system. Whether you're buying a coffee, you're paying the salaries of your employees, or you're receiving a government payment, the payment system is part of the daily experience. It matters not just to central bankers, economists, or technologists, but to every Australian. Given its importance in our lives, it's vital that the payment system provides its users, that's the households, the businesses, and governments, with a range of valued and trusted payment services. The RBA, through its Payment System Board, is the primary regulator of the payment system in Australia. The Board and the RBA work with participants in the payment system so that it meets the needs and expectations of the Australian public. Now, the RBA also performs some other crucial roles in the payment system. For example, we operate the infrastructure that transfers money between financial institutions when individuals, businesses and governments make payments. We also issue Australia's banknotes, which are still a very important part of the way people pay in Australia. Our role in the payment system complements our other responsibilities in the economy and the financial system, setting monetary policy, safeguarding financial stability, and providing banking services to the Australian government. So in the spirit of Bradfield, my speech today will focus on the importance of continuing to build a modern, innovative and robust payment system in Australia and the roles that industry and the RBA can play in this process. In doing so, I'm going to cover three aspects of our payment system: digital payments, the RBA's infrastructure underpinning the digital payment system, and cash. Now, Australians rely on digital payments such as cards and bank account transfers to support their day-to-day activities. These services have become more important over time. Today, Australians make, on average, around 700 digital payments per year. That's up from around 100 per year at the turn of the century. As users of the digital payment system, we expect the services for sending and receiving payments to have certain attributes. Typically, we want these services to be four things. We want them to be safe. So we want to feel confident that our money and our information won't be lost or stolen. We want them to be reliable. We want to know that these services will work when we need them to, that payments will go through successfully to intended recipients. We want them to be low cost. We want the prices to be fair and affordable. And we want them to be easy to use. We want payment service to be simple and convenient so we don't have to spend a lot of time and effort using them. So in my view, the Australian digital payment system already does well in delivering these attributes and meeting users' expectations. Indeed, I often hear from people that come to Australia that they're very impressed with the quality of our payment system. But this doesn't mean there's not room for improvement. And later in the speech, I'll outline several areas where I think there could be further progress in the digital payment system. The RBA helps to deliver these key attributes through the Payment System Board's mandate to promote a safe, efficient and competitive payment system in the public interest. Sometimes that means working with industry to balance these attributes against each other to reach the best outcome for Australian people overall. So you might be familiar that the RBA currently has a review of merchant card payment costs and surcharging. Now, this is a good example of attempting to balance not only the desired attributes of payment system, but also the multiple views of providers and users. We're currently consulting on our preliminary views on potential regulatory changes that could be in the public interest. So I'm not going to discuss these issues in this speech, except to say that we're going to take the time to get these changes right. Now, there's a range of factors that can help deliver the desirable attributes of Australia's digital payment system. Today, I want to focus on the key role of innovation. Ongoing innovation by providers of digital payment services, so that's banks, fintechs, payment infrastructure operators, we need ongoing innovation from all of these to keep the digital payment system fit for purpose. Because the external environment and people's needs and expectations evolve over time, the payment system must adapt to remain safe, reliable, low cost and easy to use. This is no different from other forms of infrastructure which also require periodic investment. For example, transport infrastructure like buses and trains need upgrading from time to time to integrate new technologies and make them safer and easier to use. A key focus of innovation by the payments industry over the past decade has been the introduction of easier ways for people and Australians to make and receive payments. The development and adoption of new payment options in Australia has been in some respects world-leading. A good illustration of this is the widespread adoption of contactless payment, card payments. They're often referred to as tap and go. This happened much earlier in Australia than in many other countries. The introduction of contactless card payments was made possible because of innovation and investment across card issuers, terminal providers and businesses. And it didn't happen overnight. We needed a critical mass of cards issued with chips and terminals accepting tap and go for it to get momentum. I actually recall that the Commonwealth Bank ran a very small scale trial in the Southern Shire, but it didn't really take off. And it was only once the big supermarkets got on board and picked it up that there was actually momentum. And that was what drove a broad change in behaviour. This demonstrates the benefits of innovation sometimes only become evident when it reaches a minimum scale. Another example of innovation by the payments industry was the introduction of Australia's fast payment system, the new payments platform, in 2018. This allows people to transfer money to another person's bank account in a matter of seconds, 24 hours a day and every day of the year. And the use of Pay IDs, for those of you who know what they are, they allow NPP payments to be addressed to someone's phone number or an email address, which has made initiating payments between accounts easier and safer. For payments innovation like Tap and Go and NPP to be a success, they require widespread adoption. This is commonly referred to by economists as a network effect, whereby the value of a service increases the more people use it. And we see network effects play out in other forms of infrastructure too. So, take the example of electric vehicles. For electric vehicles to be a viable choice for most people, there needs to be a widespread and reliable network of charging stations. But it's not just about the quantity, it's also about standardisation of those charging stations. When charging points use common connectors, an EV can charge anywhere. And as more charging stations are built, EVs become more attractive to consumers. And as more people adopt EVs, then the incentive to invest in charging infrastructure grows. So it's a virtuous circle, and each new connection strengthens the network and increases its value for everyone. It can sometimes be challenging to achieve a network effect in private card or account-based payment systems without wide payment industry and public sector support to facilitate a level of coordination. Banks and other payment firms have a strong commercial incentives to innovate in their own branded payment services, but they're also often less motivated to enhance shared infrastructure that those services rely on. And at times, this has led to coordination and standardisation challenges that prevent progress on innovations that would benefit the broader public. It's in these situations that the RBA can step in and encourage the industry to collaborate to upgrade infrastructure or develop industry standards. And a clear example of this was the strategic review of innovation in the payments system that we undertook more than a decade ago. This review identified key gaps in the system that needed to be addressed through cooperation. These included real-time payments, 24/7 availability, the ability to carry more information with a payment, and simple addressing. This laid the groundwork for the development of the NPP that I noted earlier. Now, I want to be clear here that developing the NPP wasn't a top-down directive. It came from identifying the problem, presenting the evidence, and working with the industry to find a solution. And in my view, this was an example of where the industry took the bit between its teeth and ran with it. They did a good job. And that spirit of collaboration, building consensus rather than imposing regulation, is the way we've achieved many of the enhancements in Australia's payment system. Now, progress hasn't always been smooth, of course. After the successful launch of the NPP, adoption actually was slower than expected because of delays in rolling out of key services by some providers. So, in response, the RBA wrote to the relevant major banks requesting that they deliver key services by a certain date, and then we monitored their progress in doing so. Use of the NPP has since picked up, and it now processes an average of around 5 million transactions every day. The RBA's involvement in the development of the NPP illustrates how we can be a catalyst for industry innovation in Australia's payment system. I'm confident that without our actions, the fast payment capabilities that Australians now benefit from would have been much harder to achieve. Now, despite the progress made to date, there are aspects of the digital payment system where further innovation is required, whether to build the capabilities needed to unlock future opportunities or strengthen the system against emerging threats. As Brad Jones, the RBA's Financial System Assistant Governor, noted in his recent speech, innovation and resilience are not opposing forces. They can and should reinforce one another. And in each of these areas, the RBA and other regulators are cooperating with industry and the government to achieve outcomes that can benefit the broader public. The first area of focus we have is modernising the account-to-account payment system. Now, an important conversation is currently underway about the future of Australia's bulk electronic clearing system, affectionately known as BECCS. Now, this infrastructure you may not know about, but it processes batches of individual payments like payroll and government support payments. Now, BECCS continues to provide a reliable and low-cost bulk payments, but it's ageing and it lacks features that are expected in a modern payment system and that support innovation. And these things include real-time, 24/7 processing, and the ability to include detailed payments data. All of these things are available in the NPP. So in late 2023, the payments industry decided to work towards winding down BECCS by the end of this decade. Now, the RBA, we reviewed this decision, and we concluded that there are a number of challenges that the industry must address to ensure an effective and orderly transition of payments from BECCS to alternative payment systems. And the most fundamental of these is the need to develop a vision for the future of account-to-account payments in Australia that benefits the Australian public. So what this means is we need to consider how to achieve safe, reliable, low-cost and easy-to-use payments between bank accounts in the future. So in response, the relevant industry bodies recently launched a public consultation on the future of account-to-account payments. And they've also established an account-to-accounts payments roundtable, which involves the RBA and, importantly, the Treasury, the Federal Treasury as well. The roundtable is using feedback from the consultation to develop a shared vision by the end of this year and a plan for achieving that vision by mid-2026. This work will consider the potential trade-offs, such as those between payment cost and reliability, between innovative and legacy systems, and between customer needs and payment provider priorities. As with all payment systems, the interests of various parties are not necessarily aligned. That's what makes it challenging. Nevertheless, I would encourage all industry participants and the public sector to take this opportunity to work collaboratively to develop a system that delivers the attributes the public expect and that supports innovation and resilience in our economy well beyond 2030. Achieving this is in all of our interests. The second area where progress is required is enhancing cross-border payments. Innovation matters not just for domestic payments, but also cross-border payments. Cross-border transactions, such as when people send money overseas, can be relatively costly and slow. I've certainly experienced this myself. In an increasingly interconnected world, it's crucial that cross-border payments benefit from the types of modern technologies that are underpinning improvements in domestic payments. And this is a central theme of the International Policy Agenda to enhance cross-border payments. Australian regulators and financial institutions are playing their part in this international effort. A priority for the RBA has been engaging with industry over the adoption of richer data and new capabilities in Australia's cross-border payments infrastructure. Now, a good example of this is the recent introduction of the International Payments Service on the NPP. The International Payments Service allows incoming cross-border payments to be processed on a real-time, 24/7 basis, so Australians can receive funds in their accounts faster. And it's really pleasing to see substantial growth in the number of these payments processed over the past year, including outside standard business hours, which is great. Now, a major challenge in cross-border payments is managing financial crime risk. Compliance processes at financial institutions are extensive and complex, which slows transactions down and increases their cost. To help address this challenge, the RBA has collaborated with central bank partners and the Bank for International Settlements Innovation Hub on a thing called Project Mandela. And this project explored the use of digital technologies to automate compliance processes, reducing risk and the potential for failed transactions. And the adoption of these kinds of solutions could ultimately make cross-border payments faster and cheaper for consumers. Now, the third focus area is combating fraud and scams in payments, which features very heavily in the media, as it should. As anyone who's experienced a fraud or a scam would know, they can have a serious and lasting impact on people and organisations. Implementing effective measures to combat fraud and scams is therefore vital for ensuring our payment system is safe, protecting users and supporting confidence in digital payments. It's imperative for governments, regulators, and the payments industry. Now, innovation by payments providers can play a crucial role here. For instance, the new confirmation of payee service that's being rolled out on the NPP represents an important industry collaboration to help reduce certain types of scams. It enables people transferring funds to someone else to verify whether the account details, including the name, exactly or very closely match what they expect before they proceed with the payment. This complements similar functionality already available through the PayID service. Individual banks are also implementing their own innovative measures, such as using artificial intelligence to detect high-risk transactions. The fight against fraud and scams will no doubt require further innovation, adaptation and cooperation by the payments industry. We can be certain the fraudsters won't stand still in their efforts to steal people's data and money. One important example is the need to protect card users against advances in quantum computing, which is expected to result in current encryption standards for payments being broken sometime in the future. So this requires migrating card payments to the advanced encryption standard, which is a quantum safe solution. So that's another big project that really needs to get moving. Now, a final focus area is strengthening operational resilience in the payment system. This objective is about ensuring our payment system is secure and reliable and will remain so in the future. Payments infrastructure is often compared with plumbing. People don't notice it until something goes wrong, and when it does, you have to fix it quickly. Today's operating environment is increasingly complex with many risks. There's cybersecurity threats, they're more frequent and sophisticated, and they're complicated by growing geopolitical tensions. Technology systems are growing in complexity, and some operators are still very reliant on legacy systems. And third-party technology providers are increasingly performing critical functions. A failure in one could have ripple effects across the system. And for those of you who have been keeping up with the Amazon Web Services outage recently, would demonstrates how that can impact. To manage these risks, financial institutions and their technology providers and operators of critical payments infrastructure must strengthen their resilience across three fronts. The first is prevention. Strong cybersecurity, backup systems like multiple data centres, and staff and user awareness to avoid things like clicking on malicious links and inadvertently sharing information. There's detection, having tools in place to monitor, identify and scan for threats and vulnerabilities. And then there's mitigation, having the capability to respond quickly when issues arise, minimise disruption and restore services promptly. The RBA has a role to play here as it oversees the governance and operation of payments and settlement systems. A key priority is ensuring these systems have a strong operational risk management culture and capabilities to manage risks effectively, including those faced when maintaining critical legacy systems or upgrading systems. Beyond these oversight activities, the RBA is also researching system-wide risks, as well as approaches that would help boost the overall resilience of the payment system. And a current area of our focus here is understanding how interconnections between systems can amplify outages. This work, hopefully, we're aiming that this work will help industry better prepare for potential operational problems across various parts of the system. Now, alongside its policy role through the Payment System Board, the RBA operates Australia's interbank settlement system, the Reserve Bank Information and Transfer System, called RITS. RITS enables banks and other approved institutions to settle interbank obligations using their accounts at the RBA. So when you make a digital payment in Australia, the movement of those funds between financial institutions takes place using RITS. RITS is critical to Australia's financial stability, ensuring payments are settled safely and efficiently without the build-up of payment obligations and settlement risk between financial institutions. RITS currently settles around $300 billion a day. So that's the equivalent of turning over Australia's annual GDP about every 9 days. It's a lot of money. When a critical system like RITS experiences a disruption, the impact can be widespread. And unfortunately, this was evident during a major outage to our systems in October 2022. Following that incident, the RBA commissioned an external review and has since launched initiatives to strengthen RITS's operating model, its IT controls and governance. And these initiatives are intended to ensure that RITS operates at the extremely high standard of availability and resilience required for an important national system. Over its 30-year history, RITS has evolved in line with payment innovations and the needs of the public. One of the most important milestones was the launch of real-time gross settlement in 1998. This change allowed banks to settle high-value payments in real time, payment by payment, and that would alleviate the risk involved with waiting until the next business day to settle those obligations. There was another notable change in 2018 with the public launch of the Fast Settlement Service. So the Fast Settlement Service enables real-time 24/7 settlement of payments made via the NPP. While the FSS handles much smaller volumes than values than RITS, so it only handles about $5 billion daily, it processes high volumes, about 4 million transactions a day, most in under a second. So while RITS continues to work well and remains secure and efficient, we recognise that it's is the central settlement infrastructure for Australia and it therefore needs to remain fit for purpose, not just now, but into the future. So in 2026, we're going to be exploring options to modernise RITS, including assessing a few things. First of all, whether modern data exchange methods can improve the user experience for the banks. We could look at whether operating hours could be extended or made more flexible. And we're thinking about whether settlement using central bank money could be made available for a wider range of transactions. Now, in parallel to this, we've also been researching how new forms of digital money, such as central bank digital currency and privately issued tokens, may be used to support wholesale payments and settlements. And this is providing valuable insights into how the RBA's settlement infrastructure may need to evolve in the future. With payments and financial market transactions innovating rapidly, modernising RITS is essential to ensure Australia's payments infrastructure remains fit for purpose, supporting innovation, resilience and economic growth well into the future. Now finally, while most payments are made using digital means now, cash remains an essential part of our payment system. Cash contributes to the resilience of the payment system because it's an important backup method when digital payments are not available. This includes during system outages and natural disasters, such as the floods in Queensland earlier this year. And cash also supports an inclusive payment system. 1.5 million Australians still rely on cash to make their everyday payments, including some older Australians and vulnerable members of our society who may have fewer available payment options than others. And cash is a store of value for people, including during times of uncertainty. So during the COVID-19 pandemic, between 2020 and 2022, for example, we issued over $30 billion worth of banknotes, mostly 50s and 100s, which tend to be held for precautionary purposes rather than day-to-day transactions. So for these reasons, the RBA and the government are committed to ensuring that cash continues to be a viable payment method for as long as Australians need or want to use it. And to this end, the infrastructure underlying the cash system needs to be as efficient, sustainable and resilient as possible. The RBA actually plays a very important role in wholesale cash distribution because we're the sole issuer of Australian banknotes. We issue bulk quantities of banknotes to the major banks, mostly from our distribution, processing and storage site in Victoria. And the banks then distribute these to the broader community. And we also support the availability of high quality banknotes around the country through various incentive arrangements. Now, just as innovation has shaped digital payments, it's been important for meeting our objective to provide banknotes that are secure and trusted by the community. So you may remember that the RBA, in fact, pioneered the use of polymer or plastic banknotes in the late 1980s, introducing several groundbreaking security features, including a clear window with a hologram. The greater security and durability of the polymer banknotes introduced in the early to mid-1990s contributed to a sustained period of low levels of counterfeiting and longer circulation life. And this led to, we estimate, around over $1 billion in savings. As technology evolved in the 2000s and the 2010s, we saw counterfeiting again begin to rise. So in response, the RBA further upgraded the security features of our banknotes between 2016 and 2020. A combination of these new banknotes and effective law enforcement has helped to again reduce counterfeiting to low levels. In 2025 now, you'd have to handle on average around over 165,000 banknotes before you received a counterfeit. And in 2015, it was probably only 32,000 banknotes you had to handle before you come across a counterfeit. So while the RBA plays a key role as the issuer of banknotes, the movement of cash around the country and into the hands of consumers and businesses relies on the banks, the cash in transit companies, and the broader cash industry. The decline of cash, the use of cash for transactions, has put the cash distribution system under pressure. We are participating in discussions with the major banks, the broader industry and the government about how to evolve the operating model to support the future viability of cash. In July, the financial regulators issued a consultation paper on potential regulation to better manage risks in the cash distribution system. In addition, the RBA has worked closely with government agencies and key participants in the cash distribution industry on business continuity arrangements in the event of a disruption to cash, the supply of cash services. The work to support a more efficient, sustainable and resilient cash distribution system is ongoing and will require cooperation and a shared commitment to meeting community expectations for continued access to cash services. So in conclusion, Bradfield gave us the Sydney Harbour Bridge, a connection built to serve generations of people he would never meet. But he also dreamed of a different connection, a comprehensive underground rail system in Sydney that didn't come to life until decades after his death. His story is a reminder, and Ben's made this point as well, it's a reminder that visionary infrastructure often takes time to realise, but its impact can last for generations. Like Bradfield, we must think beyond the present. Our payment system must remain safe, reliable, low cost and easy to use, but also innovative and future ready. Any less, I think, would fall short of what Australians have come to expect, and it would limit our economic potential. Maintaining and evolving our payment system is therefore not optional. It is an economic imperative. Just as John Bradfield envisaged a nation connected through steel and stone, we must now envisage a nation connected through trust, technology and innovation. Thank you.
Governor, thank you for delivering the 2025 Bradfield Oration. I was taking notes furiously out the back, actually. I was going to think I was going to need two pens at one stage. A quantum computer falls into the wrong hands and is used to beat existing encryption, steal our money and data, and cause chaos. It sounds like the plot of a Mission Impossible movie, but it's not fiction, is it? I mean, is it the biggest threat, the biggest new threat to the payment system?
Certainly it's something I worry about. I mean, if you believe what they say on the tin of quantum computing, what takes 200 years to decrypt now, to break, will take a matter of minutes. So it is a big threat. But I have to say, I think, as I said, the advanced encryption standards have been developed to actually meet that challenge of quantum computing. But it's scary. You know, you don't... at the moment, we trust our financial institutions to keep our data safe, and they do that through encryption. So it is a worry that we need to make sure we keep up with that quantum computing situation, because otherwise it's not safe.
Yeah, I was, as I said, listening very closely, and I felt that you threw in an extra line there, an extra message to industry that perhaps they're not moving quickly enough on this. We don't want to be caught in a situation where we need to send a self-destructing message to Tom Cruise to get us out of this, do we?
Actually, I watched Mission Impossible on a plane recently, and no, we don't. And I think the banks and the financial institutions get it, but it's not just the financial institutions. Most corporations these days, whether it be telecoms or banks or grocery stores or whatever, they all hold information and they all have encryption and cybersecurity associated with that. So everyone has got to be engaged in this process of upgrading our encryption and our security.
But would you like to see swifter action, better collaboration at an industry level to make sure that we've got this in place before something goes wrong?
I think the banks are well onto it myself. I'm that's my focus, the financial sector. And I'm very comfortable that they are all taking this on and they're taking it very seriously.
Of course, fraudsters are already fleecing billions of dollars a year from us. Have you or anyone close to you ever been done in by a scam?
I personally haven't been, but I'm not so silly as to think I couldn't be. They are getting better and better. My husband got a message the other day that looked like it was from NAB, but I scrolled back and it looked like it was from NAB, but it wasn't. It was a spoof. And so we went to the website and we checked it out and we figured it was a spoof. So you've got to be very, very careful. But it also demonstrates that it's not just up to the financial institutions. There's an ecosystem here, the telecommunications companies. I'd have to say that the social media companies, they have to be ready and willing to take down spoof and scams. So everyone has got to buy into this.
You mentioned the review of card payment costs and surcharging, and I know that the RBA has run a genuine consultation process and really listened. But in your personal view, is banning surcharges and driving down back-end costs for business still the way to go?
So no decision has been made, so I can't give you a definitive answer. What I can tell you is that when we introduced surcharging in the early days, it was to allow merchants to give a signal to consumers that certain payments were more costly for them to take than others. In the early days, it was sort of used like that, but increasingly it hasn't been. And what we're observing now is that typically small businesses who face high payments costs are passing them on, and they're just passing them on in one flat fee. So the question we were asking is there a better way to do this? And I'd have to say we've got quite a lot of feedback. We've received 170 submissions on this and other issues. And there's a few camps. One camp is that no, leave it as it is. It's perfectly fine. Mostly from small merchants, probably. Another camp is that, well, no, make debit cards surcharge free and allow people to surcharge on credit cards because they're much more expensive than debit cards to take. And then there's another camp that sort of agree with us that just get rid of surcharging altogether. So I think what we're the focus we've got here is that a lot of the problem with surcharging seems to be focused with small merchants who face high charges. So we've got to figure out a way of making sure that small merchants don't feel like they have been beaten on one hand and there's been no sort of gains for them on the other. That's the challenge, I think.
Because otherwise this would just further reduce their margins, wouldn't it not? Because they'd have to absorb it in and they're already under so much pressure.
Well, they would absorb it in or they would add it into their cost base like they do with other sorts of costs like electricity, for example. I mean, part of the challenge with surcharging now is that when we first introduced the right to surcharge, cash was about 70% of transactions. Cash is now, we think, about 10% of transactions. Most people don't carry cash. They can't avoid the surcharge. And so that's why the challenge is, well, if you can't avoid the surcharge, wouldn't it be better folded into the total price?
Understood. Now, this event is called Future Sydney. Housing supply is one of, if not the biggest challenges to Sydney's future. I know you're not responsible for housing. You've got plenty on your plate already. I recognise that. And I'm not really asking you this as the RBA governor, but as an economist and a citizen of this city, what else could be done to drive housing supply?
So you've already heard the Premier obviously talk quite a lot about housing supply. Let me make a couple of points up front. The first is that obviously housing and housing prices are not part of the Reserve Bank's mandate. Having said that, we do recognise that part of the way interest rates work their way through the economy, one way is through the housing sector. So the best thing I think we can do, speaking as the Reserve Bank, is to keep inflation low and stable because that keeps building costs and so on not increasing too much. So that's positive. And then the issue really then becomes, as you've said, supply. And it's a very knotty problem. The Premier's already set out increasing supply involves changes to planning laws and those sorts of things, and that's all very positive. But it also involves making sure that we have the skills and the resources to build those extra homes. So we need the inputs, we need the cement, the bricks, the wood. We need tradies who've got the skills in order to build these things. So we need to make sure that we've got all those resources available. And if the economy is running too hot, then sometimes that means those resources aren't available. So that's another thing. As interest rates come down, hopefully, what you'll see is people will be able to afford to build more houses, and hopefully we've got the skills to build them. So that's the second point. The third point I would make is that, and this goes to sort of supply and demand, we've seen a long-term decline in the average household size. Now, this isn't uncommon. It happens in many countries, and it's happening here too. And in COVID, it accelerated, because people decided, well, I don't want to share a house with five other people anymore. I think I'll go and share with my partner. Or actually, I want a home office now, so I'm not going to have a spare room in my unit anymore. I'm going to use that for my home office. So as the average household size declines, then the given housing stock is less, there's less of it. So the same housing stock provides housing for less people because there's less people in each house. The other long-term demographic challenge here, of course, is that there's many older people whose families have left home who are still in their large homes and they're not downsizing. So in terms of this issue of average household size, I think there is a question about, are there policies, taxes, things we do that are discouraging people perhaps from downsizing from large homes? Are there reasons why people aren't sharing more? So these are the sorts of things I think that you also have to factor into this.
So stamp duty is a considerable barrier, isn't it, to downsizing?
Well, stamp duty is, I think my predecessor called it a tax on mobility. It's not only a barrier to downsizing, it's a barrier to people moving to find jobs. So it's also a barrier for dynamism, I think, in the economy, because it basically keeps people pretty much where they are instead of allowing them to up and move.
And just to cover off on an earlier point you made there, do we need more skilled migrants in Australia to build the houses that we need?
I'm probably not going to get engaged in a migrant discussion, but I do agree that we are seeing, and we hear this in our liaison program, that there is a shortage of skills in the housing industry. And some of that is contention for resources with all the other infrastructure projects that are going on. So we do need to find a way to encourage either people to come in with these skills or people who might be thinking, they're coming out of year 12, why don't you go do a trade? These are the sorts of things we need to encourage.
Governor, thank you so much for delivering the oration for this Q&A. Would you please thank Michelle Bullock?